Welcome to The Creative Switch, the podcast inspiring the sensibly successful to switch on their unexpressed creativity for a more fulfilled life. Now, we're only on episode 2 of the new season, and already I'm learning so much from my guests about what creativity really means in practice. And I'm so looking forward to sharing the creative nuggets of wisdom from all of them in the coming episodes. In today's conversation, I chat to bespoke jewellery designer Ruth Mary Chipperfield, who made a dramatic switch into her creative business when a serious illness upended her plans while she was studying chemistry at university. Now, if you're looking to turn your creative inspiration into action like Ruth did, don't forget to listen right to the end of the episode and catch up with my creative adventures. This is where I'll be sharing the challenges I encounter and how acting on the nuggets of wisdom I've learnt from my guests and applying those learnings is helping me to move forward in my own creative projects. And if you're finding it hard to know who might be interested in your work or are struggling to communicate your work to your audience, I'll share perfect advice for you later from Andrew Sheck. Before we get to that, do remember to head to my website, nikkivalance.com, and sign up to stay in the loop with all my latest adventures, updates, blogs, and free guides to help you with your own creative challenges. First, though, it's time for some creative news in The Edge. Before we get into today's conversation, let's just take a moment to catch up on what's happening across the UK jewellery scene. Because actually, the stories shaping this sector continue to echo the themes we explore here on The Creative Switch. You might remember my chat with Harriet Kelsall last season, where we talked about the emotional depth behind bespoke design and the ethics of storytelling through jewellery. Harriet's studio was recently nominated for Bespoke Jewellery Retailer of the Year at the UK Jewellery Awards, a recognition of their commitment to craft, care, and client-led design. I'll put a link to Harriet's episode in the show notes. And while the jewellery show at Olympia is now over, it left behind some powerful conversations, apparently. A focus on ethical innovation, digital transformation, and emotional resonance of retail were front and centre. It appears there is a clear shift happening from sparkle for sparkle's sake to jewellery that carries meaning and memory and intention. One particular trend that's gaining traction is permanent jewellery. These are pieces, often bracelets or anklets, welded directly around the wearer without a clasp. They're designed to be worn continuously, symbolising connection, commitment, or simply a moment worth holding on to. There's also a renewed interest in rub-over settings. Apparently, and I'm not an expert here, but that's where the metal gently encases the stone all the way around, offering a sleek and secure finish. It's a style that prioritises durability and subtlety, perfect for those seeking elegance without excess, and clean lines, and less chance of item snagging on your clothes. Head to the bottom of the show notes, where all the links I've mentioned are listed under The Edge. Have you been wondering what to do with a special piece of heirloom jewellery passed down through the family? Well, maybe you've always wanted to try your hand at silversmithing, but just don't know where to start. Do share your thoughts or questions via my website contact page or on Instagram at Nikki_Valance. I really do love to hear from you. So, if you've been reflecting on your jewellery story, you're already part of the shift we've seen across the sector. And today's guest is someone who helps turn those reflections into wearable, meaningful art. She's a bespoke jewelry designer whose work is rooted in emotional storytelling, ethical redesign, and the art of helping people reimagine what they wear and their connection to it. Ruth Mary Chipperfield. Hello, Ruth, and welcome to The Creative Sweat.
Thanks for having me.
I would like you, if you can, rather than me introducing you, to explain a little bit about who you are and what you do now, and we can go into the stories behind that afterwards.
Yeah, sure. So I'm a goldsmith and jewellery designer. I specialise in heirloom redesign, and I love creating something out of people's sentimental jewellery that they've inherited. And I think often we've all got these pieces that are really sentimental. We remember twirling the ring around on Granny's finger while sitting on her lap in front of the roaring fire. And often it's those pieces that then sit in a box and don't do a great deal for years. So it's my absolute passion to bring those back out and redesign them so that people can enjoy them in the future.
Fantastic. Such a great concept. And I'm sure you've got many stories that go behind the pieces as well. We'll talk about your process in a little bit. But what I'd like to do first is go back a bit and work out, if it's possible, if you know, how you got to where you are now. So maybe a little bit of a potted history of the types of careers or decisions you've made in your life that brought you to this point.
Yeah. So as a child, I always loved doing anything creative, not two-dimensional, so not a blank piece of paper. And I think that's the misconception people often have, is that creativity equals drawing. It doesn't. So I always loved creating things. I had my junk drawer, and I wanted to be an inventor. I've always loved how things work, the science, and I did then take a scientific route. I studied chemistry, and it was only then through circumstances that I sort of came back to the creativity. So I've got a condition called narcolepsy, and for 3 years I had time out. My husband was my full-time carer. I was collapsing about 30 times a day, and so that's when the turning point happened. And I started to pursue jewelry and got good at it and turn it into a business.
Wow. Okay, so the person inside, the creative person inside, was always there, as you say. And I love what you say about the narrowness that people attach to the word creative. People do consider it to be art. Let's ask you that question, first of all. What does creativity mean to you? Your own kind of personal connection with it and the definition that you think it has.
I personally believe that creativity is a way of thinking. Okay. So you can be a creative person without making anything physical. I think it very much links to problem solving. And I think there's this view in the world that you've got productivity and then creativity is somehow something separate to productivity. That's ludicrous and they very much link, but it very much challenges my own thinking, because I often sort of get into the zone like, no, I need to be productive. And then I almost block out the creative side and realize I'm not very effective at all. So I think creativity really is something that influences every aspect. It's bringing together multiple ideas. People ask me, where do I get my inspiration? And I find it very difficult to give a single answer. Because sometimes I'm inspired by client stories. For example, I did an engagement ring and I was chatting to the couple and they knew they wanted a sapphire, probably a teal sapphire. So I had some to show them. And they didn't want the engagement ring to look like her engagement ring from a previous relationship, which had a sapphire. So that's absolutely fine, not a problem. But the conversation wasn't really going anywhere particularly, and they were struggling to sort of choose. They had one sapphire that they liked but weren't quite sure on it. So I paused the conversation and I said, right, we're going to change direction. What do you like doing together? And told me about their coastal walks and how they'd walked all along the south coast, which sounds like a nightmare to me. I'm really not into walking at all. Kind of think, okay, I've seen a lot of green. it's all green. I'm not into, I mean, give me a tropical garden and it's a different story and you've got details everywhere. But anyway, they were doing this coastal walk and I said to them, what was your favorite beach? Told me about Padstow Beach. I said, have you got a picture? So they pulled out this picture on their phone of Padstow Beach. Beautiful. The coastline kind of goes outwards a little bit and then you've got this view of the sea all around on three sides. I held up the sapphire next to the photo and it was the exact colour of the water. And it's in that moment that you know you're onto something. So the engagement ring was then inspired by the waves from that picture and the metal kind of making the shape of the waves and that sort of thing. And I think sometimes you, as a creative person, you just have to have the courage to break out of the narrative and go into a different direction and trust the process that all paths will lead to the right point. Yeah. But when I'm working with clients, it's also a challenge to guide them on that process and make them comfortable in the unknown.
Yeah, wow. I guess some of your clients are creative thinkers and are creative people themselves in a different discipline, perhaps. But I don't know whether this happens to you with your clients. There's a lot of people I speak to when they ask about the podcast. And so many people say, oh, I'm not creative. Yeah. And it comes from probably something someone told them, or maybe their own impression of what creativity is, and they didn't think they could draw, therefore they can't be creative. And quite a lot of them are sort of quite scientific and quite logical. And maybe they do jobs that are professional, and they have just blocked it. They've basically told themselves this story about not being creative. So are they like that? And if they are, how do you get them to come along the process, the journey with you to get to the end result?
Yeah, most of my clients will say exactly that. Oh, I wish I were creative. Oh, I'm not creative. Oh, I wish I could do something more creative. But no, that's just not me. I'm logical. Those kind of things. And those are usually my clients. The people that outwardly say, oh, I'm creative, they're the kind of people that, oh, then I've also got a side gig, which is buying, testing and selling recycled and dead stock gemstones and selling them to other jewelers. And sometimes amateur creatives that don't do it professionally. So that's a little side gig of mine. So people that outwardly say they're creative, I talk to more in that capacity. But clients, it's actually quite rare that I'll have a client that really sees themselves as a creative person beyond maybe they do something, but they don't really like to show anyone.
So how, if they're like that, which most of them seem to be, how do you take them on the process? How do you open them up to be part of that creative process to get the end result?
Yeah. So one question I really like to ask is, in the context of talking about a piece of jewellery that I'm designing for, and quite often people will come to me and they don't really know what they want. And it's often the case that they've then, particularly if it's an heirloom redesign, which it isn't always, I do a lot of pieces from scratch as well, but they've been to a jeweler's, they've taken this piece of jewellery that belonged to their grandma, that's, it might be a thin 9-carat ring with some scratched garnets in. I mean, monetarily not valuable, but the sentimental, I mean, you hear their story and you know it's of value. And they'll have been into a jeweler's and they'll have just heard, oh, it's not worth repairing. Oh, no, it's not worth anything, not worth doing anything with. And they're just crushed. It's often those people that then haven't even considered what jewellery they could do. So I'm going on a bit of a tangent here. And they just need ideas and guidance. And often it's a case of asking people, what is it that you don't like?
Uh-huh.
Because if they've not sort of let the creativity flow, they might not really know what they like, what they want, what's possible. But if you say, what do you not like? People know.
Yeah.
And then you can kind of build it from there and have a look and think, okay, what about it is you don't like? So it might be a stone setting and the gemstones all got metal all around. It's in a collet setting and, oh, it looks too chunky or anything like that. And then you've ruled out 70% of styles with that one question.
Yeah. So that's a really good starting point. You know you're not going to disappoint them because they've discarded all the things that are not going to be satisfactory. what often is happening at the moment when you can see that it's clicked? So you mentioned the story there with the coastline and the colour of the gem. What's happening to them? Can you tell when they're starting to realise, oh, this is where we're going? Does it sort of show up obviously in their faces or in the things they're saying?
Yeah, I can see from body language. I mean, everybody's different and some people are more difficult to read than others. So I always check saying, I think I'm reading this. Tell me if I'm wrong. And because I think sometimes initially when I meet with people, people are almost worried to say that they don't like my ideas. And I really like it when people tell me because it just makes the conversation flow. No one's pretending. I mean, they can hate my ideas and that's okay. I mean, it's not about what I like. I mean, it's lovely when the two overlap and I create something where I wish I could keep it. But often it's people suddenly look relaxed. Whereas before, they're sort of a bit tense. Oh, where's this going? I'm not quite sure. Not always, but it's that kind of, but the thing is, quite often, I'll have a conversation and I call them curiosity calls with people. And we don't get the final design on that call. I kind of gather information and then I'll go away and sketch, do some rough quotes, that sort of thing. So it's never just a single meeting anyway.
No, I mean, I think the creative process, I learned this the hard way. I'll tell you a bit of a story. Years ago, I did a pottery course, an evening class.
Nice.
And I didn't realise it was actually a City and Guilds level one. And the tutor was really, really serious, like really serious about creativity. And most of the people who were there were just really doing it to explore it for themselves and to use it as a way of switching off from work.
Oh, dear. Read the room.
I know. Anyway, so she kind of was sticking to the curriculum, which was we had to do certain things and we were learning techniques. So we were making things, but we were making them for the sake of learning the technique rather than for producing something we were going to keep necessarily. And we were all getting quite frustrated because it was a year-long course, but we didn't have anything to show for what we were spending our 2 hours a Tuesday evening doing. Anyway, she took us to the V&A. We went to the ceramic section and we were supposed to be finding inspiration for a project. And obviously when you do a creative qualification, you have to have like a portfolio and you have to have display the story of, yes, this is what I made, but this is why I made it. And here's all the different stages I went through to document the creative process. The problem was that we didn't really want to do that. We were just, I want to make something. I had this idea. Can I make it? So it was good that she kind of slowed us down. It was good that she was teaching us that it isn't the first thing that is the thing. As you were saying there, there's always going to be iterations. But there is this tension between wanting to actually make something and satisfying her need to tick the boxes of the curriculum. Right at the end of the year, she was unfortunately not very well. I think we missed 2 or 3 weeks with her. And so her boss stepped in and said, so what have you all been doing then? And we said, well, we've got all these half-made pieces. Oh, come on, let's get them glazed. Let's get them in the kiln. When she came back, she was like horrified that we'd done this stuff. And I ended up with, I think, 3 pieces that I then could take home. None of them were perfect, but that didn't matter. Yeah, so I think sometimes you want to have a process, particularly if you aren't yet exploring your creativity, it's the first time, you want to be told what to do. Other times, and also as you become more in tune with your creativity, you recognize that it rarely is the first step that is the one. It's true of everything. It's true of everything I do. It's true of my writing. It's true of this podcast. It's always evolving. I'm always learning. Nothing is set in stone until it is, I guess. Excuse the pun. So do you find people are resisting the fact that it can't be done straight away? Or are you able to reassure them that that's fine, it's normal, that you don't come to an answer right at the beginning?
I've learned to be good at reassuring people. And I think that's really part of the process. I'm going to circle back round to what you said about the learning process in a moment. But I think it's a case of really guiding people through. And I always say 50% of being a good jeweler, personal jeweler, is communication. And I always give repairs as an example. I had someone, I did a repair for her, and she also had another ring that had been repaired previously, and she wasn't happy with it, and she was really quite upset about it. And I said, bring it along, let's just talk about it. And essentially what had happened is she had this gold ring, and she thought it was rubies in there. And the stone had dropped out, and she looked everywhere and she'd found the stone. She was really chuffed that she found the stone, took it to a jeweler's to get them to reset it. But when she then had the ring returned, she looked at the receipt, said replacement garnet, and she was handed the ring and the stone wasn't her stone. And what I think happened, and this is what I talked her through, was the jeweler working on it probably pinged the stone across the workshop, didn't realise the sentimentality of it, thought, oh, it's fine, I've got another one, I'll put that one in, that one's a bit scratched anyway, I'll put a fresh one in, not an expensive stone, so didn't think anything of it, and then added extra metal around the setting, but the colours didn't match, and they were never going to match because of the old ring and the alloy, which means the mixture of metals in there, and it would have been very, very difficult to get an exact colour match on the gold without spending a lot of money on it. But none of that was communicated. And I think sort of for her, what brought me great joy was just being able to talk that through with her. And she went away wearing the ring because she understood what had happened and felt better about it rather than just, oh, here it is, don't really care. And then I don't know enough to know what questions to ask, that sort of thing. So it really is just guiding people through so that people know what to expect, what the process is. I mean, there's not even a single way to remove an appendix. So if surgeons have different methods of removing an appendix, then jewelers are going to have different processes that need to be communicated.
Yeah, definitely. I actually wanted to go back to your early direction, which you said came from this love of understanding things and how they worked, and you'd gone down the scientific route. Do you think you always knew that for you, science and, well, for everybody, science and creativity were the same thing or very, very closely linked to each other? At that point when you chose to go down that route, what was it that made you go that way rather than any other way at that point?
Do you know what? I think I did, actually. I think I'd always had this interest in business. And I remember this was before university, then seeing, I'd go around shops and it was sort of in the earlier days of fair trade and ethical production, that sort of thing. And I'd go around and I'd think, well, it all looks fair trade. And thinking, surely there must be a way of creating things that are just genuinely really good products, but made in an ethical way. Surely this shouldn't be groundbreaking. And surely it should be possible to do it in a way where it's not like, oh, you poor community, sort of, there's a total value to kind of empowering communities, but in a way where it's a business, it doesn't feel as charitable. And I mean, I'm still on a journey. I think on the topic of ethical things, I think there are always room for improvements. Anyone that says, oh, I do everything right and it's all ethical is kidding themselves, really. There are always room for improvements. But yeah, when it comes to science and creativity, I think, yes, I did. I mean, even when I think back to when I was giving maths tutoring while I was in sixth form and sort of early years of university, I remember I was tutoring this girl called Lucy, who was really into fashion, and she wasn't bad at maths, but she'd just been taught in the boring way and sort of rote learning and not really understanding what's behind it and that sort of thing. And I grew up in Germany, and just the way maths is taught in particular is quite different. It was all about why and how. And I mean, that appealed to my brain anyway. But rather than kind of, okay, now we're going to do geometry, I said, right, we're going to work out how to make a circle skirt. And got her to calculate it and do the diameter and then the circumference and that sort of thing. And of course, that sort of thing sticks in a much better way. But even when you think of anything being invented, you've got scientific discoveries of, I don't know, the discovery of plastic, for better or worse. But it wasn't until that was applied to something useful in a creative way that it became a commercial product and everybody knew about it. I mean, there'll be countless discoveries in the labs that are still in the labs because it's this cool, weird thing, this reaction, and no one's really worked out what it's good for.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm curious, because I did something similar. I went down the sort of science route initially. I'm curious what it was made you choose that as a route into university and beyond, rather than something else that was actually creative in the terms of producing something that people could see, touch, feel. Was there something going on? Was it your own internal expectations? Was it job security? Was it potential income? What was it that made that the route you took initially?
I mean, I think there are a few factors at play. I mean, at one point, I was vaguely thinking about going down the piano route, because played piano a heck of a lot when I was younger. It's more of a rarity now. But my mum sort of pointed out that most people that then study end up teaching, and I didn't want to do that. I did that sort of a bit when I was younger, but it's not something that I would have wanted to do long term. But then when it comes to sort of the creative side, if I just simply look back and think, okay, what GCSEs did I take? I remember wanting to do electronics, and then that clashed with other subjects. And I was always very good at the different technologies, but I didn't take a technology for GCSE just because of different subjects clashing, and science was very much up there for me. So I ended up doing fine art, and I really enjoyed it, but just simply in terms of grades, I got A stars in maths and sciences, and I got an A in art. It was always one of those where this is what I'm better at. It didn't occur to me to do an artistic subject at A level. And my parents, I mean, huge credit to them, because they really allowed me to explore my creativity and never kind of suggested that anything was just a white piece of paper or anything like that. My mum in particular, she was very good at getting me to create things. And I remember my primary school teacher, then one time then I missed a day when I was ill, and they'd all got these templates to make these little baskets. It must have been Easter or something to put things in. And I was there the next day and looking at it, and I was like, oh, have you got a spare template? My teacher said no. And I think she had one, because that day I went home, I made my own template and then made one, brought it in to show her. And her response was like, oh, yes, I knew it. She blatantly had a template and didn't give it to me. But I think I chose chemistry because I liked physics and biology, but chemistry is sort of in the middle. You can kind of go either way.
Uh-huh.
So that's the one that I then chose. I still love chemistry, and I still use,
of course,
my chemistry knowledge today in gemstone testing. Little thing where I was on a gemstone course. I can't remember the context, but the gemologist teaching, she sort of mentioned about malachite and how when you grind it or polish it, it releases fumes that are toxic. So I said, oh, okay, well, what's the chemical structure of malachite? What fumes is it? And she didn't know off the top of her head. I mean, there are 5,000 gemstones and minerals plus. You're not going to know every single one of them. So I looked up, sort of worked out in my head, oh, it releases formaldehyde, same as MDF board. That's why it's toxic. And it's those little things where I just think, yeah, oh, this is brilliant. Or another time then I went to see my tutor at Warwick University in the chemistry department, and she does research into diamonds for scientific purposes, used as sensors. We're just talking, and I was sort of having a little rant about how you've got all these silly terms like A1, 2A, 2B diamonds, and they've made up terms in the jewelry industry for yellow diamonds, and you've got blue and boron doped diamonds. And she just sort of explained it really simply. Yeah, yellow diamonds, basically you've just got a vacancy where there's a carbon atom missing, and next to it you've got a nitrogen atom. Oh. And I just love the simplicity of it. And often it is that simple. We just try and make it complicated to make us feel good.
Yeah. And also because then it's a bit like the magic circle, isn't it? Your knowledge is secret, and therefore you can charge for it.
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay. So it's never one thing. There's a combination of reasons why you take that route. It seems a sensible thing to do when you're good at something, when you're better at that than other things. I think if you're good at lots of things, it's quite hard to choose. So you tend to go with the thing that you're best at, because how else are you going to choose? But obviously, all of us are more than one thing, and you have all these different aspects to your skills and your passions and your interests. So you talked earlier about the turning point and discovering you had the condition that you have. So where was the link between not being well and then the recovery and how that became what you're doing now?
Yeah, so it was during my second year of uni that I was diagnosed with narcolepsy. I sort of powered through, missed about half the year pretty much, and it was crazy. And it was recommended that I go back a year, and I didn't want to, and now I'm so glad I didn't. And then at the start of my third year, I started collapsing with what's called cataplexy attacks. So I was collapsing about 30 times a day, and then gradually I was sleeping about 18 hours in a 24-hour cycle. So I had about 6 fragmented hours a day to do anything. So naturally, I dropped out. I did end up going back in the end. So someone with narcolepsy, for anybody who doesn't know, it's basically a sleep disorder whereby you're always falling asleep. But the bit that people don't always know is that when you're asleep, you're always waking up. So it's not really like you're asleep all the time. It's like you're sleep deprived all the time. And so it was basically like not really having slept for 20 years. And so I couldn't really read because I literally could barely see words enough to read anything that's more than a few sentences. Mm-hmm. And if I was still, I'd fall asleep. So the only way to do anything meaningful was to do something with my hands. And I'd already been making jewelry kind of as a hobby. And I went to Malvern Antiques Fair with my mum. And in between sort of powering through, I love those kind of places. And in between sort of napping in the car, going around a bit, going back, napping in the car, that sort of thing. And I loved sort of looking at vintage pieces and taking them apart, making something new with them. And my mum pointed this thing called a tatting shuttle. It's a little sort of thing with a bobbin where you wind some thread round and then it's got a crochet hook on the end, although not all of them have that. And she said, oh, buy that, you'll enjoy making with it. So I did, went to YouTube or Pinterest, whatever it was, and taught myself in about 5 minutes how to do this lace making technique called tatting. And I really loved it because also it's the kind of thing that you can make up as you go along. You don't necessarily have to use a pattern. So I started doing that and then came across the fact that you can cast things, you can make molds around things, you can recreate things in precious metal. And I'd realized by that point that if I were going to make a jewelry business, I'd definitely be moving into precious metal just from a perspective of price points and economics. So I invested in having a number of molds made and some pieces cast. Problem was, at the time, I was incredibly unwell. And so I wasn't really thinking long term. So it was at that point I realized I had to learn a whole load of new skills, soldering and filing and polishing. And it was endless. So I ended up putting a lot of money, which was sort of our savings and made things very difficult at the time, into creating this collection of jewelry pieces that were hand-stitched lace in solid sterling silver.
Wow.
And people love them because you've got sort of the older generation that kind of have lace making is quite a fond memory. They maybe remember it a bit more than the younger people where it's those vintage vibes. So you actually really get a whole sort of several generations that like the same thing, which is quite a rare thing to kind of get for a style. So yeah, that's how I kind of started creating jewelry, and then it evolved from there. But my philosophy with creativity has always been think it, design it, learn how to make it, or get someone else to do that step.
Yeah. So are there some things you don't do because you don't specialize in them?
Yeah, most definitely. And it comes round to where you were saying about the pottery. It's that tension between just going for it creatively and the crafting skill. And I think often those two things can be quite separate. And the sweet spot is when you've got the real skill combined with the creativity.
Yeah.
But I mean, there are a lot of things. So mold making and casting, I don't do. My landlord wouldn't be happy if I had a furnace in my house. Stone setting, again, I mean, it takes you a good number of years, 5+ years, to really be a good, well, more than that, it's a lifetime skill to be a really, really good stone setter. I don't have that time to give. So I have someone who does the stone setting for me. hand engraving for certain pieces, that's another thing that I get people to do. So it's really a team effort. So where I started out doing most of the designing and making, and I have some pieces that I do make myself start to finish, but where it sort of started out as that, it's then evolved into much more of a team effort, just because the level of the designs that I'm creating require it.
Yeah. And you then, I guess, have identified what your thing is, the thing that makes it your piece is your input. But you outsource to the specialists for the areas that aren't your thing.
Yeah. Don't get me wrong, there are times where I really wish that I could do certain things start to finish, or that I could do it. But actually, this is also a business and there are people that can do it quicker than me.
I think that's true. It's a really good lesson for anybody who's thinking of taking their creative passion and making it into a business, is to recognize the essence of what it is you're trying to do, the thing that you have to offer. I think you're probably like me. One of the things I find really hard is not having creative control over everything. And I think you just have to get to the point where you go, okay, it doesn't really matter if I do that bit or not. No one's going to know. And actually, it's not the best use of my time.
No.
And actually, it's something they're better at. And so it is the best use of their time. And as you say, it becomes a team effort. But at the beginning of anything, I think you imagine it's going to be you doing everything. And then you recognize as it turns into a business that that's just not possible, because you only have so many hours in the day and you can't do everything.
That's the thing. And I mean, I remember I can't remember when it came out, but I think it was that skull that Damien Hirst did covered in diamonds. And at the time, I didn't have the knowledge I did now. And I remember thinking, oh, well, he doesn't even make it himself. And I think that can often be the thinking sort of when you start becoming more and more creative. It's sort of that whole thing of like the value is in doing everything yourself. And I certainly had this sort of thinking when I first started out of this thing is more valuable if I've actually made it all myself, when actually it might feel like that, and to other creatives it might feel like that, but actually the people that buy from me, they'd rarely class themselves as creatives.
I think what that is that you have to really know what you're trying to do, what you're trying to say. And when it comes down to it, I'm guessing in your business, the value you're adding is, yes, some of your technical skill, but it's actually your creative thinking, it's your design, it's your pulling together the story with the item. That's where the value is.
Yeah.
That's the bit these people couldn't do for themselves, or couldn't express if they went to another jeweler, can you do this for me because I need it to look like this and this is the story behind it, blah blah blah. They couldn't do that bit. You've got to find what your unique thing is and protect that. But actually everything else has to go to support that, rather than it being all by you. I mean, I'm guessing that's how it works.
Yeah, for sure. And I think a lot of people are good at different aspects. And someone who's a coach will probably be able to unpack this further. But you've sort of got people that really like the completion of a project, or really like being totally absorbed right in the middle of it and kind of moving something forward. And then you've got people that really like the start and all the ideas. And I'm one of those people. Mm-hmm. So I need people around me that can help me with other steps.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. Okay. So
I think a lot of creative people are like this, sort of you start something and you've got all these unfinished things and...
Yeah.
It's never linear.
No, there is an art, we use that word, but there is an art to recognizing which projects need to have an end date, which ones really matter, and which ones were just an exploration. And the ability to let go of something that's been started and not finished, it's really hard for people who are creative, because you feel so much of you has gone into the thing that's been started. You feel it should be finished. And actually, probably it's different when it's a client. You've got to finish it. You've got to get it done. You've got to find those other people
to help
you finish it.
It becomes a lot easier when it's for a client, then it gets done. I mean, my husband wants a ring. I mean, this idea has been sat there for about 2 years. I've done a few experimental things. I keep saying, oh, where's my ring? I said, where's the money? I mean, I'm not being paid for it. So it's just not happening. But equally, sometimes I just really like to skip ahead. So for example, I'm designing a brooch at the moment and it's for a particular organization and competition, whatever. And I really want to just go straight to designing it in 18 karat. But I'm having to force myself to do it in silver first because otherwise it could potentially end up costing me a lot of money.
Yeah. And the more you develop your craft and the more you understand how to get the best out of yourself, the more you have to put your own discipline in place. I think that's one of the hardest things of being an entrepreneur or an owner manager is people imagine you can just find your muse and use it when it comes and the rest of the time just floating around. And actually, it's hard work to channel your creativity into something that has an end goal to it. One more thing before we sort of talk about going forward, I just wanted to ask you, when you were at that period where you didn't have much time or energy at the beginning of your condition and trying to work through that, how did you use those 6 hours to explore your creativity? How did you manage to do that when you also had to eat and all the other things? Why was it that you chose to do rather than anything else? I mean, you've already talked about not being able to read, so not having enough attention span for that. But what was it about that time that enabled you to use those very small amounts of time you had, but focused on this?
I mean, to be honest, I can't really remember an awful lot from that time period.
No, I can imagine.
There was an element of, oh, this is fun, I'm going to do it. I was already doing bit of it, already had stuff around. It's something I already did in my free time. And then it slowly morphed into, I'm falling through all the gaps when it comes to disability benefits. What the heck are we living on? And so, I still don't know the answer, to be honest. I don't know what we lived on. I honestly, sometimes I kind of think, how the heck did we get through? I mean,
yeah. That in itself was a process. It was just you had to keep going and find a way through, didn't you? So how are you now with it all? Have you got it all under control or do you have...
I mean, it's a mix. I'm on medication, I'm on stimulants. I timed my dexamphetamine stimulant for when this podcast was going to occur so that I could give my maximum energy. I get a lot of migraines as well, which is really unfortunate. And so it's the medication side, but then there are lifestyle things as well. So for example, I find that being gluten-free gives me an extra couple of hours a day where I don't feel awful. And then I started on a ketogenic plan, which is not something I'd recommend to the general public. You really need to know what you're doing. And that probably means that I feel awful about 70% less. So it's worth it. I mean, it's annoying because the majority of time when I'm out and about and someone's, oh, do you want this snack? No, I have to politely decline. And so, yeah, it is a big lifestyle aspect. And then a load of nutritional supplements and being really careful to manage stress levels, which is something I'm continuously learning about. So there are a lot of things that I have to put into place. So, and it's either that or one of my medications, which is what I finally got funding for towards the end of those 3 years when my husband was my full-time carer, but it really messes with the brain and the mental health aspects that result from it aren't pretty. And ever since having my son and coming off all my medication during pregnancy, then I've managed to stay off it. And the difference on my mental health has been profound. So people would say, oh, how do you do it? Or the sort of being keto, it sounds so hard. And I just say, yeah, pick your hard.
Yeah. It's a slightly more healthy hard, a slightly easier healthy hard than dealing with the medication and the side effects of that. And also, I guess you've been living with it for a long time now. You understand what happens if you don't get it right, you know, the impact of that, the consequences of that. So it's not hard when you know it's going to prevent something really awful.
That's the thing. I mean, if the differences were minor, I think it would be a lot easier to kind of think, oh no, I'll just eat this, or I'll just eat that, or I'll just eat a potato, or I'll eat a banana, which are things I don't have.
Yeah. But
it's so clear cut. It's a no-brainer.
Yeah. It's not really a choice you have to make anymore because you know what's right. Okay. Fascinating. Fascinating stuff. And I'm sure we could talk for hours, but I want to give you an opportunity to talk about what your plans are for the next little while. People will be curious about how you find clients and, you know, all of that stuff. So what are you out and about doing for your business and for your craft?
Yeah, so a big part of it is when it comes to getting clients is networking and creating videos that are sort of more educational and story based. So I'm doing a fair bit of that, and then designing bespoke pieces for clients obviously takes up a big chunk of my time. I'm also designing some more pieces for my website. So some ready-to-wear pieces, going to be some birthstone pieces, and yeah, things that you can really like layer with different things. So doing more limited edition pieces with recycled gemstones, because I just love recycled gemstones. And so I'm going to be doing some limited edition pieces with some of those as well. So yeah, lots of designing and new designs. I'm always full of ideas, too many ideas to actually execute them all. But
yeah, I know what you mean. I have the same problem with stories. It's whenever I'm solidly working on a project. So at the moment I'm in the middle of novel number two. There are points when my brain goes off and thinks, oh yeah, but when you've written this one, there's another, oh, that's another idea. And you have to keep going, no, okay, part that, focus on what you're doing, because you just can't stop the ideas from coming, which is why, as you say, when people ask the question, where do you get inspiration from? It's almost impossible to pin it down, because your brain is just constantly in the background, spotting opportunities and little things that then combine into something else. And you say, oh, that would be useful. Most of the time, it's not even conscious. It just occurs, doesn't it?
Mm.
Okay, well, I'm so glad we got to actually finally do this, because we talked about doing it quite a while ago. And you have a fascinating story. And I just, partly what I think really attracts me to what you've been talking about is the reuse part of the reuse, recycle ethic and way of living, which I think is so important in today's overconsumption.
Because reusing for the sake of it, people aren't interested. Yeah. It's just sort of, oh, well, why, if I can get a better thing that's new? But when you combine it and actually make that into a unique selling point, then it's different.
Yeah. Thank you so much for spending time with me today. And yeah, I'm sure we'll stay in touch.
Thank you so much.
That was a great conversation. I do so admire Ruth's determination to build a creative business which suits her skills, her curiosity and lifestyle in the face of such a challenging illness. Do check out examples of her beautiful work on her website, along with links and how to connect with her in the show notes. Now it's creative adventures time, and I promise to share some advice from the fine artist Andrew Scheck on connecting with your audience. Last time I talked about a new publication that I'll be hosting on Substack. It's a place to publish longer form content, build a community and an audience who could choose to support my work financially. As I already talk about my own experiences of creative living through my blog, I knew I wanted to explore the topic of creativity and creative living more broadly somewhere else. I had an idea of who might be interested, but wasn't sure how to let people know. After one of my visits to a book club where I talked to the members about all my creative activities, I got some great feedback. The organiser said she was really inspired, but also felt a little exhausted just thinking about everything I'm doing. I took a step back and remembered Andrew's advice. In his episode in season 2, he said that the making and the selling of something you create are completely parallel worlds. They are actually worlds which can conflict. I realised that whilst I had a clear idea of what I wanted to write about in my Substack publication, I needed to look at my plans from the audiences, from your perspective. Where would this new publication on creativity fit in with my blog, the podcast, the novels? Who might be interested, and what was I trying to say? I took some time to map my creative ecosystem and looked at where people will find me, what they might be looking for, and which of my outputs could actually help them. By following his advice and viewing the publication as separate from me and making the distinction between the writing of it for myself and the communication of the ideas to others, I was able to see both who it was for and how it would be useful. Just as a quick aside, don't forget, if a podcast is the creative adventure you'd like to begin, check out the links for Alitu, my podcast recording and editing software, and Captivate, my podcast hosting software. I really couldn't do it without these great, easy-to-use tools. Have you found it hard to see your work from an outsider's perspective, or struggle to separate the making from the selling, or even doubt that you can see yourself turning your creativity into something that could sell? Or maybe you have actually found a way to balance the two roles. Do share your experiences with me through my website or on Instagram. The links are in the show notes. I love to hear all about the ups and downs of your creative adventures. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of The Creative Switch. If you enjoyed it, please leave a review over on podchaser.com. And if you've got any questions, please let me know on Instagram at Nikki_Valance. I do hope you join me next time when I'll be revealing the name of the new Substack publication and talking to Hannah Ash about how her pivot from head of music at a prestigious school to interior designer has opened up a whole new creative avenue she hadn't even considered. Until then, keep creating. And remember, why survive when you can thrive?